SiriusXM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick. Enough! Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back, hour three at the races, and absolutely thrilled that, Chuck comes on usually by phone, and of course there were some times at Saratoga live, but in the studio, I'm gonna have to put out a picture too.
I'm in the presence of greatness,
Casey.
Casey, the best producer in America.
Exactly right.
Do you know it's the first time I've ever met Casey?
Well, he surprised me this morning when he said that he talked to you so many times, and I thought that maybe when we were at Gulfstream that time, but that was Chet. That was with Chet, and then I thought maybe, some other occasion you'd come to either here or to, not 17th Street, to the old Fort Lauderdale studio, but... pretty funny.
It is. I mean, I live
close by.
5 minutes from here.
Yeah.
Surprised we didn't run into each other at Steak and Shake.
There's any number of dining establishments the two of you could easily have.
We're not eating that anymore, though. Now we're reformed.
Well, you know what? Although you had your bad influence pal here for a week.
Yeah.
Dave Spears.
Dave Spears.
You put him on the plane last night.
This morning.
Yeah. Oh, this morning? Okay.
Yeah.
All right, so you can go back.
Fort Lauderdale Airport, 5.05 a.m.
Perfect.
23 minutes to get around once.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Phew. All right. Well.
It's the new LaGuardia. It's LaGuardia South.
That's sort of true. Compared to going and flying to Miami years ago, then I thought, oh, Fort Lauderdale's fabulous. Then my parents had that place in Boynton, and my mother would want me to fly into West Palm. Which is like a private airport.
Yeah. Flying private is probably the way to go.
That's what we'll start doing.
We got the race to the Learjet.
Well, Chuck is joining us. And for those of you that haven't either heard him in a while or didn't see some of the wonderful things, the really thoughtful pieces that he's written and have been circulated on and about the internet the last several weeks... Chuck is, for 2 years now, part of the executive committee of the Florida HBPA and has really been a proactive and young blood. You're not as young blood-ish as you used to be, but we can still call you young blood on the HBPA. And, aside from the local issues, Chuck has got a graduate of the University of Arizona racetrack industry program, has just always an acute sense of an understanding of where things are in the industry. And to be honest, I said at the beginning of the show when you were going to visit, that you were way ahead of the curve on a lot of the issues that seem to have come to the fore here all at once. And that's probably the biggest part of the challenge that they're facing in California and then collectively as an industry is that so many things have come to bear at the same time.
Well, yeah. That's very true. I think what we're seeing is a culmination of a lack of any sort of central planning. I think we've had a lack of leadership. The leadership in this business seems to want to shout down any person that has any kind of thought that doesn't go with the agenda that they're being served. Everyone operates as individuals. The horsemen are to blame. The owners are to blame. The breeders are to blame. The racetracks certainly are to blame. The regulators are to blame. And, you're dealing with a business that had a monopoly on gambling for, half a century, 100 years. And that created an environment where I think people thought that it would always be. There would never be an end to this. And just not even dealing with the California situation, just the fact that sports betting, which ironically was legalized because of a facet of horse racing, the casinos, how we've basically screwed that whole thing up. It's just everybody's out for themselves, and no one is willing to compromise. And this is what you get when you don't have a monopoly anymore. And the situation at Santa Anita is just a microcosm of how we handle a lot of other things, except those things don't get plastered all over the nightly news. We're only seeing this because of the animal rights people and because we're dealing with death, which is certainly a lot more of a hot topic than simulcast rates or something like that. But this is how this business deals with everything, in a inane way where people's opinions trump facts, where they trump numbers, where there's a lot of CYA covering your ass going on at all times. And everybody wants their little piece of the pie. The problem is the pie is spoiling. And I'm not really sure how to fix any of this. I mean, if you made me czar of racing and you said you can do whatever you need to do within legal, within legal parameters, obviously we couldn't set up a single ADW throughout the country because it would be a violation of antitrust laws.
And, although that project came very close to fruition, the Satish's plan that was inches from the goal line.
But I just think that we would have wound up in trouble with it because someone would have sued and it would have been a violation of I'm not a lawyer and I didn't stay in a Holiday Inn Express last night, but it's been explained to me by lawyers who are smart that it would have been difficult to do. But it's just, how do you step back from all this? I mean, dealing with the Santa Anita situation, no matter what rules we pass, no matter what laws we have, no matter what regulations, no matter how much oversight, no matter how many x-rays and ultrasounds and things we do, it's still going to happen. It's just like you can be the best driver in the world and cars now are 100 times safer than they were years ago, but there's still going to be accidents. You can't get to a 100% accident-free place. And the danger is, and that's not acceptable. I mean, we can't say, we're going to have breakdowns. What are you going to do? That's not acceptable. But the problem is, and the danger is, and where they're really screwing this up is that they've set these standards and they've said, all right, we're going to do this, 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 and this. And yet it doesn't help at all because the issue is one of, it's one of flesh and blood, and all the rules and regulations in the world aren't going to stop accidents. And we talk about pre-existing conditions. Well, I bet there's a lot of people here right now listening to this radio show that have a pre-existing condition that they have no idea that they have. And that's the same with horses, in that there's a lot of gray area, and there's times as a trainer where, you know, you're a little bit, maybe you'll back off on a horse because they just don't look good. They're just not eating as well. There's signs that you look for. You know, there's no magic wand we can bring in and go in the stall and run over the horse. What's going to say, hey, you know, look at the left hind, look at this, look at that. It's a lot of guesswork. Even x-rays, they don't always pick up something. There's been, I can think of 20 cases, and I'm a small operator. I mean, I've been doing this for 20 years, but I mean, I don't have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of horses. And I can think of 15 times where a horse had an issue. We tried to identify the issue. We looked at it. We x-rayed it. We ultrasounded it. We did scintigraphy. And it wasn't apparent or obvious what the issue was. And I can say that, I stand on a platform and say that you can check my record for breakdowns versus pretty much anyone else, because honestly, my staff and my veterinary crew, and they've done a really good job over the years, and we don't push, we don't take chances. Has that hurt my career? Absolutely. But I can also live with myself knowing that I haven't had a horse breakdown in a race in a long, long time. Long time. That being said, I had a horse get hurt a couple months ago. 2-year-old broke a hind leg above its hock in half. First work going 25 seconds. And the horse had a bone disease that we had no idea existed. And outside of doing an autopsy, you wouldn't find it. So that horse might have got down the line. He might have got to the races. It might have happened, and it wouldn't have mattered what protocols you had, and it wouldn't matter if he hadn't had bute ever, if he hadn't had Lasix ever, if he hadn't had seen a whip ever. Sometimes it's still going to happen, and the danger of putting out press releases and saying this is going to do this, this is going to do that, is that you can't prevent certain things, and all the initiatives that they took, ironically, most of which horsemen have no issue with. The Lasix is really the issue. But the other issues, you know, stepping back, the anti-inflammatories, pushing back the injections, all that, I don't really think most people have a problem with that. And the people that do, you know, there's always going to be a couple of people that are going to cry, that live in the past, that don't understand. As one of the things we're doing at the HVPA with Gulfstream Park, and Gulfstream actually initiated this, is we're in the process of putting in a stronger claiming rule in regards to voiding claims. And this rule should be in soon, where we're going to have a panel of vets that, within 24 hours of a race, if a horse has suffered a significant injury, they're going to void the claim. And I know there's going to be people that are going to complain about that, but the fact of the matter is, we have to do everything we can to discourage people from putting horses in races that they shouldn't be in, period. And this isn't poker. This is horse racing, and there's lives at stake. This isn't like you fold a hand. And that's been the analogy I've heard, but it's too late. It's too late to go back to that. We don't. This is 1975 anymore, and we have to deal with that. So, you know, it's a tough road to try to go down, because no matter what you do, as long as you're racing, there's always going to be issues. And like I was saying before, I sidetracked myself, but you know, the whip and the Lasix, Peter doesn't give a shit about that. They don't care about that. That's just window dressing. They're just waiting for horses to die. And every time one does, they're going to jump up and down. And it doesn't matter what we do. And that's part of the problem. The problem is, a lot of these things should have been taken care of years ago. I think it's not ironic to see some of the language used by animal rights groups mirrors almost exactly what's written by some industry groups, which always was something that I never could understand, why people praised them for saying the things that they did. We've had a campaign in this country against racing from our breed registry for about 15 years now, and they've denigrated everyone that's trained and been a veterinarian, worked on the racetrack, by saying that Lasix is this and that and the other thing. And it was always an odd argument to me, because Lasix actually treats an issue that horses inherently have. And somehow or another, Lasix has become the inherent part. It's always kind of been a little bit, I'm not, I'm just not sure why it became such a firestorm of an issue. It just doesn't seem to make sense, because your customers never really had a problem with it. And the customers are the people putting the money through the windows. And I've never heard outside of a very tiny, small, minuscule portion of owners complain about it. I have lots of owners that complain about vet bills. But Lasix is the one thing that everyone has equal access to. It's cheap, it's affordable.
It's effective.
And it works pretty good.
Yeah.
And, you know, I understand, like, if you're sitting in a situation where people are coming at you from all angles and you have, you know, issues, bodies strewn all over the place and you're this and you're that, it's an easy thing to say, well, you know, let's get rid of that. But I think the one issue that I've tried to make as clear as possible without, you know, while still being sympathetic to the actual crisis that we have at Santa Anita, is that this business is not in good shape. I mean, we're in bad shape. I don't know anybody that can look at the handle numbers and know that a growing percentage of that is not actually people betting. It's machines betting. And they're betting for rebates. They're betting to just simply try to break even, make a little money here and there. And those are very, they're very price sensitive. They're being sold a signal at a very small price. So our handle is down significantly when you actually look at where we were compared to ourselves 10, 12 years ago. The foal crop perhaps is the most important indicator that no one seems to really have done anything about. I mean, everybody says, well, geez, it's going down. And obviously, foals essentially equals owners. But what has actually happened? What have the sales companies and the breeders really done to try to attract people? And what have the racetracks done? And what have the horsemen's groups done? I mean, we have a tremendous depreciation schedule available for horses before they're put into service now. I mean, you can write 100% off. I have an accounting degree. I'm not a very good accountant, but 100% depreciation is like, you know, the gold standard. I know there's one significant owner that's gotten into the business recently that bought extremely high dollar purchases, and I know someone that knows him and said to him, you know, boy, you just seem to buy $1 million horses, and he's like, well, yeah, I'd rather pay a sales company and get a horse than pay the IRS. And you don't see that anywhere. The tax advantage is like almost hidden. And I mean, these are the things that we have to do. Is like, people are so concerned about animal rights groups. Well, we have to worry about staying open before those. I mean, we're killing ourselves. Our business is not getting better. I mean, we've kept the same, maintained about the same race schedules, but the foal crop's gone down 12,000 horses in a year for the last decade. So where are we going to get the horses from? And, you know, all this bad publicity, all these negative tones that are surrounding the game, it's certainly a very poor atmosphere to try to attract new ownership and new investment.
Well, and one of the things I wanted you to circle through, it, because you hinted at it, and I know if I bring it up to you and tie it to, frankly, the majority of the horses that went wrong, and we've got a very similar list going back to 2012 in New York, is the financial pressures on the smaller outfits. And very few people around the game, you have been one of the few that have spoken up on this huge, and frankly, to tie it to a social issue, an income disparity, or in this case, a quality horse quantity disparity that has created a scenario where horses that might be vulnerable are being, you know, being, you know, part of barns that, and certainly we know under the scenario from December, we're being urged to run. And so outfits that are under tremendous financial stress already, owners that that are in, you know, in that same arena, and it's a have and have not scenario, and there's no doubt that it contributed here.
No doubt. Well, everything's financial in the end. In the end, it all goes back to finances. I mean, I've been preaching about the super proud trainer issue for years now, and it's gotten worse. It's gotten worse as the group of owners. And this is one of those things that it's hard to see because I can't give you a number. I can't say, Steve, there was 17,342 owners 10 years ago, and now there's 9,418. There's no number. You just have to figure it out. And from what we've seen, you look at the foal crop going down. That's lessening the demand for foals. If there was a demand, believe me, there would be more. But one thing that no one wants to talk about, and it's kind of one of these things that's a huge factor. And it's a huge factor for my business. It's a huge factor for almost, you know, all trainers outside of the very, very top ones. Is a lot of people just don't want to pay. And there's a lot of trainers that are being trained, or horses that are being trained on deals, where there's no money being transferred to the trainer for his services. And the only money that is keeping that horse going is a split of the revenue. Whatever the horse earns, the trainers sometimes work at a 50-50 deal, and whatever the horse earns, the trainer gets half, the owner gets half. But if you consider, you know, where you are in the country, obviously some places it's cheaper to keep a horse than others, but, you know, say on average it'll cost you, I don't know, say $2,000. Well, you have to make $2,000 for that horse to break even. Well, say the horse doesn't start or runs poorly.
Gets hurt. Nicked up.
And it'd be rare for a trainer to have one horse on a deal. And, you know, you start to look. Well, say he's got four or five and he's had a bad year, had a bad couple months. Well, all of a sudden the trainer's half-assed bankrupt. And there's always a gray area with the racehorses. No horse is 100%, 100%. It just, you just couldn't know it even if they were. You'd never know when there's some underlying issue. But especially with the cheaper horses, a lot of times a cheaper horse is cheaper because of their physical makeup, because that they're crooked.
There's a flaw somewhere.
Right. Well, when that concussion hits their leg, it doesn't go straight up like they would on a correct horse. It goes one way or another way. And those horses,
They're
vulnerable just to being sore, to having more, to being not tougher to train. You can't train them as hard. You can't do as much. It's a real issue, and it's never been addressed. I mean, I don't even see people admit it that it happens, and that's a big problem because, from a trainer's standpoint, it's a terrible deal, and no trainer should ever take that deal. But the fact of the matter is it happens because you can't train an empty stall. And one of the biggest issues with the super trainers that is kind of unsaid, and it's not really a public thing, is that there just aren't that many good owners left for everyone else. And for the first half of my career, I trained a lot of second-string horses for big owners. Horses that didn't really measure up and maybe, you know, would fit better at a circuit I was on, a Tampa or a Parks or even a Monmouth, a Turfway in the winter. But those guys even have those horses now. I had a lot of horses for the vaunted middle class, you know, the middle market that's gone. Well, it's gone because no one took care of them. The racetracks didn't take care of them. The sales, the consigners, everybody wanted to hit a home run. They wouldn't sell a horse for a reasonable price anymore. The vets fail them. And what happens is those horses don't get bought for $25,000. They get bought back. And then they get sent to a trainer on a deal. And a lot of my owners that would buy 2-3 yearlings a year of 25,000-35,000, they've taken their money and they've bought a leg of a partnership horse now. They might own 3% of 4 horses. And a lot of them, they don't want to do that. So you know what they've done? They feel like they can't win, they can't compete. The expenses have gone up. Outside of a few places, purses have not kept up with inflation. And people have gotten out of the business. It's a fundamental issue, but it will never be solved because no one wants to talk about it. And I mean, I've gone from having 15, 60 horses to having 12. And I haven't kept track of how many people have asked me to take horses in the last 2 years, but I'd say probably 3 out of 4 wanted a deal. So that's why I have 12 horses. Because it's hard enough making it when, you know, I haven't exactly burned it up here the last 4 or 5 months because I just don't have replacements for my horses. And the cheaper horses, once they get through a condition or two, there's just really not many places to go. So it's just the whole thing, the whole system that we have is convoluted. And that's the problem. And that's not... I don't know why the racetracks never addressed this. And probably because they didn't care. And especially once they got alternate source of revenue. I mean, I know that it's caused a lot of issues, but I mean, think about where we would be if we didn't have it. How many tracks would be closed? So yeah, it's kind of a necessary evil. What we did with the revenue from casinos was stupid. I mean, we poured it all into purses. We poured nothing into anything else. Places like parks where they have a ridiculous takeout schedule. I mean, have a year-round circuit in a major metropolitan area with you know, really good purses for that level of horse. Why wouldn't they want to cut their takeout level to the minimum they could be? Why wouldn't they want to try to grow the game? Because all you're doing when you do that is turning people off. And it's just another one of those things, and not just to pick on them, but from a pricing standpoint, I just don't see how we're going to compete. I really just don't understand how we're going to compete, because young kids today, they're into video games. Now they have esports. I mean, this is kind of a crazy thing, but it was on 2 weekends ago. It was a Sunday afternoon. It was on NBC for 3 hours. Video games. They pay these kids a lot of money, and the ratings are good. They had a tournament of some sort at the Wells Fargo Center in Philadelphia. They had 18,000 kids watch other kids play video games. You think they're going to come bet horses? Come on. It's we're not even in the same ballpark as that. Everyone's so far ahead of us. And it's just laziness. We had a monopoly for years, and everybody just was happy with their piece of the pie, and everybody fought over the same piece of pie. But now, you know, I don't know how to walk it back. I don't know how we're going to compete against sports betting in game betting. To be honest, it's going to be run better than ours. It's going to be marketed better than ours. It's going to be policed better than ours. And I just don't see how we can fight it.
From a management angle, and from the current structure with the 36 jurisdictions independently run, you do have the concept when it comes to this Integrity Act, but that that concept is somebody to do testing, and the confidence in having that work is personally is very low. You've talked about this yourself, and for those that are saying, "Oh, USADA," that's not going to solve the infrastructure problems and any of the systemic issues that you're discussing.
No, of course not. See, listen, I don't care who tests us. It doesn't matter to me who tests us. It doesn't matter to most horsemen who tests us. Who does the testing is not the important part. Who cares? What difference does it make? You know, 99% of guys, they want rules that we can follow. Tell us what we can do. Tell us what we can't do. Period. We'll deal with it. I don't think a national program is a bad thing. I've never thought it was a bad thing. I just think it's an impossible thing. I just don't see how you can get 36 states on board. I mean, we have laws in Florida, and being on the HVPA was something I never really wanted to do, but I was kind of talked into doing it, and I'm happy that I've done it, because even though it takes up a tremendous amount of time, and, you know, we're all volunteers, which is something that people often forget when they harp on the HVPAs, you know, we're going up sometimes against regulators and against racetracks, and these people are all paid well. We're volunteers. We get paid nothing. But, you know, it's a second job or third job. But, you know, some of the things that I've learned about, you know, the state, and I mean, in this state, in Florida, we don't even have a racing commission. We're part of the Department of Business Regulations. I think there's 38 different divisions. So often people, owners send their license application to Tallahassee and they die up there. You know, they get on somebody's desk and they took 2 weeks off and, well, shit, you know, hell, we'll process it when we get to it. You know, meanwhile, we got a whole, you know, you got a horse ready, and some of the rules the HVPA, the FHVPA has worked to get the RMTC rules and regulations enacted here,
right?
And we got the rules enacted, but then they never bothered putting the penalty phase in.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, and this is the regulators. It's kind of like the tail chasing the dog. You have the horsemen going up telling the regulators, please put the
right
penalties in. This is how it works, you know. And it took 2 years and lawsuits to get this done. I mean, I just think if I had to say one issue that exists seemingly everywhere in this business is distrust. I don't trust Churchill Downs after seeing what they've done to Calder. I don't trust, you know, nameless, faceless breeders after I've heard they're giving things to babies. That it'd be like, you know, giving Osphos to a baby or Tilden to a baby. That'd be like giving steroids to a six-year-old kid. I mean, I don't trust the results that I see in front of me often. At the racetrack, when the horses just, you know, miraculously turn around. I mean, the fans, the bettors, they certainly, if you have any presence on Twitter or social media, you can certainly see the feelings that they have. They don't trust anything either. And I think that's a big issue in that. That no one really works together. You know, we might work together to get this done. We might work together to get that done. But in the end, everybody's playing, you know, holding their cards close to the vest. And that's why we have the issues that we have. That's the problem with the Stronach Group making a proclamation without even, like, discussing it with horsemen. Even if they wouldn't have liked it, it should have been discussed. They should have said, listen, this is what we plan to do. You know what? You're not going to like it. You're going to bitch. You're going to moan. But hey, we have a crisis. Let's all be together. I mean, just look at the Santa Anita situation for a second. You have horses being hurt, injured permanently, dying. It gets into the mainstream media. And, you know, the executives at the racetrack, they work there. They're doing a job. They don't make policy. And you had a guy twisting in the wind out there. And I wrote about it in one of my pieces, isn't that where was the NTRA? Where was the jockey club? Where was the horsemen's organization? Where was everybody? Nobody said a thing. Days and days and days. You know, that's the thing, is that when we have an issue, everybody kind of likes, like, well, you know, let them deal with it, and, you know.
In fairness, they were asked, and this has come up before, they were approached, and they were told to stay out of it. NTRA specifically volunteered with their group, response management group, that, and they were told, no, thank you. Just an FYI on that.
Yeah, well, they don't have to listen to them. They're the NTRA. You know, you do. You put out a press release and you say, listen, we're really concerned about what's going on. We're willing to donate any resources at any time and any effort we can make. You know, this is a great game. People love their horses, blah, 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 blah. That's all you have to do.
Yeah.
Whether people believe it or not. But silence is the worst thing. It's the worst. Because then you seem complicit. You seem like you don't care. And that's how it looks. And that's how it looks on a lot of things. That's how it looks on a lot of things.
Well, we've talked about this with the teletimers and some of the stewarding issues. And, I mean, there's, we had.
Yeah,
this,
our normal issues.
Yeah,
you know,
the everyday issues.
Like ridiculous disqualifications and times. You look at the times and you know, you just roll your eyes. And it's, it just stems from, I wrote a Twitter thing yesterday. So this whole where we are now is because we've had 50 years of no leadership, and no one's ever really tried to bring people together. No one wants to compromise, and this is where we're at. And you know, I hate to be like so down about it, but how do you get a positive spin on this?
Who was it that somebody wrote something I saw early this morning, you know, that there is the potential, for instance, the whip issue, Chuck, there's an example. Jay Hubdy wrote and brought out Trevor Denman has been trying to get the whip addressed for 30 years,
yeah.
That it would be an easy win. In fact, you talked about this the other day. There's some easy things that could have been, that can be at any time. And the fact that it has to be done under duress doesn't, it sort of mitigates the opportunity to do it.
Exactly. Listen, the issue should have been solved years ago. They should have said, listen, this is the new rule. You can hit your horse 3 times in a race, period. If you want to, it's the first 3 strides, the last 3 strides. That's it. 3. And the first time you get fined $1,000, second time you get fined $10,000, the third time you get fined, you get 6 months suspension. It solves the problem. I mean, the other day, Winx has won 32 races in a row. Okay? The darling of all darlings. You know what the jock did at the 8th pole? He smacked her. You know why? Because she kind of hung, and I got a feeling the trainer might have had her just, you know, he might not have had her quite, she might have been 99%, but. And no one said a word. No one said a word. Because there's really no reason to say a word. It wasn't like it was a... it was part of the way we know horse racing. And I get, you know what, you can't have... a guy like George Chavez would be dead today. Shopping. But you can't have it. I get it. I get you can't be whacking the horse 15 times... We all understand that, but when you ban something, you can't go back. And they never really took into consideration the voice of the participants, the voice of the fans. Not the fans, the people that bet. Fans are just fans. In this sport, fans are
Well, as I famously said, people that buy briars.
It's just toys. A different dynamic. I mean, honestly, our customers are our bettors.
Yeah,
sure. I'm not a customer of the Miami Heat if I go to a game, but it's a different dynamic because they're making money off of TV revenue, off of merchandise, off of ticket sales, stuff that we don't really make money off of. It's a little bit of a different thing. And it would be nice if people, participated in the process a little bit. And to me, a gradual ease out is the best way to do it, as opposed to just, okay, no more whips, And having them carry it but not use it. It's just this kind of a bizarre thing. And I get the animal rights activists are circling, and I get, they're going to have polls and they're going to try to do this and do that. But is it really going to help when a horse breaks down? Not a bit. Not a single bit. And that's the issue, and that's the danger of making proclamations, and regardless of what their intention was, when you ban something, you can't bring it back. And the whip was probably the easiest thing to do, but I don't know how. At some point, we still have to have our game. We still have to. It's a competition. We're trying to win. That's the one thing that gets lost, I think, sometimes. And yes, we want everyone to be safe, and we don't want issues. We care about our horses. We care about the jockeys. We care about the exercise riders. But we're trying to win. And I know there's a lot of safety initiatives that have been promoted, and we go back to the lack of trust. Are the tracks really going to pay for these things? That's my question, because tracks bottom line us everywhere, every track. And I understand it. You are running a business. Some of these corporate places, they're running a business. They have stockholders. They have, they have quotas. They have to meet numbers, blah, blah, blah. But, where do we draw the line? And what's important, what's not important? I mean, it's just a giant mess, and it's just a symptom of a lack of collective effort everywhere. I just think it's ridiculous to think that regulation is going to save the sport. It just doesn't seem to make any sense. People don't go to football games because the referees are doing a great job. I mean, sure, they tweak rules and things like that, but. Like, I get it. We've operated under different rules for a long, long time. The RMTC has done a lot of great work, and I hate to see some of the things that are said, like, drug culture, blah, 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 blah. When I started training in 1999, you could give a horse in Kentucky 15 things within 24 hours of a race. 15! Legally! You could give 5 things 4 hours out. 5.
The adjuncts.
Yes. And now you're going to tell me things are worse now? When you can give,
I've tried to explain that there's less medication with the list.
Less.
You're down to a couple dozen things.
And we're talking about legal medication.
Legal medication.
And I understand, of course, that was kind of outrageous, and it never should have been. It never should have gotten to that point. But it was one of those things where, who's in charge? Who's supposed to police us? The Racing Commission? Do you think they're not experts on these kind of things? And that's racing. Yeah, we'd have been great if we had a commissioner, at least one with a clue. I'm sure if we had a commissioner, he'd be clueless, because that's us. But yeah, it'd be awesome. But how do you do it? How do you figure these things out? How can you manage?
Well, the way, and you particularly, knowing from the HBPA experience, and I just came from the convention weeks ago at Clearwater, and also at the Mid-Atlantic meeting with Alan Foreman and his group, it has to be done the way the successes that are out there, including the widespread adopting of RMTC's initiatives, whether it's NUMP and the schedule, the multiple medication, the multiple violation program, the way there are successes, the success of the pushing steroids out.
Absolutely.
Which took 2 years.
Honestly,
it was not
Steve,
18 months.
The truth of the matter is the RMTC is perfect proof that regulation doesn't really matter to the sport on the level that these people think it's going to matter. Because
if it did,
lots of changes
have been made. Yeah.
Listen, we all knew when 8 Bells, who didn't have steroids in her system, broke down, and the steroids push and the Dutro, you know, talking about it. We all knew steroids were on the way out, and nobody pushed back. Nobody pushed
back. No, everybody said that, you know what?
But you know what happened?
It's time to go.
You know what they told us? They told us, you get rid of steroids, or at least you push them way back. Where you're not, you know. I mean, and I don't want to hear, well, you know, guys still use them. Yeah, they're using them 5 months out. They're using them the day before, okay? It's like, it's way, way different. But we were told that the horses will make more starts, that the horses will be healthier, that certain trainers will stop winning, that the other trainers will start winning, that the fans, the bettors will have a more confidence in the game. And none of that happened because you can't tell if a horse has got steroids in them or not when you watch them on a TV screen. You can't. You can't tell if a horse has had it's treated with Lasix or it's not treated with Lasix. You can't. And I get it. Yeah, there's guys who win 42%. They're not winning because they got Lasix or illegal medication. The truth is, the less legal stuff there is, the greater the advantage of the people that will do something illegal.
And if you're not catching them now, how are you going to catch them later?
I would love if the USADA would come in and catch those guys. But, I mean, let's face it, they caught Lance Armstrong after he already retired. He's only worth $1 billion. I mean, I wish I was doing something and I got caught and I only had $1 billion left over. You know? I mean, like, that's the... Put it this way. Here's all you need to know about USADA. Boxing won't use them. Okay? That bastion of integrity. They use the other guy, the VADA. I mean, it would be great if someone would come in and do something like that. But, you know, it's the same thing. Money, testing, this and that. I've said for years, testing is probably not... We should be putting more money into surveillance. This isn't like people. We're not testing people who can, you know, go anywhere 24 hours a day. We know where the horses are.
Yeah.
We know exactly where they are. You know, it's not hard. The horses aren't going down to the corner and, you know, sneaking out and getting a hit here. I mean, we know where they are.
Except we've got a much different, we do have a much fairly different scenario than at any time in my memory, and that is the training centers and horses rotating, you know, cycling in and out of off track training facilities.
It's simple. Just tell them if they want to have their workouts counted, they get surveilled.
That's interesting. There you go. There's a terrific, absolutely.
It's not hard to do this. Like, the Jockey Club paid McKinsey, like, I don't know, God knows how much. I kind of got like 5 guys from Twitter and told them the same thing. Like, you know, it's just, a lot of these things aren't that hard, but there's just no will. There's no will. If I ran a racetrack.
I was going to say to you, we got about 5 minutes.
If I ran a racetrack.
Name two or three things, Chuck, that you think could be impactful and executable in the short term.
Day one, I would call in trainers and I would that are suspect. And I'd say, listen, you may just be great trainers. I can't tell you if you're not or not. You know, if we haven't been able to find anything, well, you know. But my job is to sell bets and perception is reality. So if you keep winning at 40%, your perception is going to be at a different track. If you don't like it, and your owners don't like it, too bad, get out. Jeff Girl's done it, and believe me, I disagree with a lot of stuff he does. A lot of stuff. And I think he makes it personal. I think the stuff with the drivers is petty. But look at his handle. They handle $2.5 million a day. Everywhere else, they're doing $500,000-$600,000. And yeah, mile track racing is a little better. But you can bet, and you know that it's probably on the up and up. And if there's a guy that comes in there and is too good, he's gone. I'm a horseman, and I'm saying this. This is how it is.
Why? And one question that casual observers and even not so casual people that are actively involved as serious players, are curious or and don't understand is, and I don't want to use the term whistleblow, but why they speculate, why are horsemen, why don't they speak out? And I mean, the obvious answer is you don't want to be thought of as a sour grapes guy, etc. But it is a question that kind of hangs over everything.
Well, who can speak out? Me. But I mean, who's the guy's got 150 horses? He doesn't have time to be on social media talking about these kind of things. He actually has to work. See, that's the thing is if they wanted to shut me up, they should just send me more horses, because then I'd have a lot less time on my hands. But it's what form do we have? And a lot of the people, they feel like no one would listen to them. You know? I mean, they would, honestly, they just don't think that anyone would listen. And they would think that, you know, there's a lot of influential people who have opinions that most of us don't agree with. And there's just not that many owners in this business that have good horses. And I understand why some of the bigger guys can't say anything, because, you know, they're making a lot of money. They're doing very well. Their first job is to their family. It's their first responsibility is to their family. That doesn't mean that they should cheat or they should condone it or this and that, but I mean, I get why they don't speak out. I wish they would. Grand Motion has spoke out number of times. But it's hard. And believe me, horsemen are complaining to the tracks all over the place. It doesn't get in the public's eye, but there is a lot of bitching about things. Some of which, might not even be accurate, but to think that horsemen just, you know, pat these guys on the back and go along, that's just not true. I mean, you don't see many fist fights or anything, but it's a difficult situation. You know, I mean, and like, listen, I've rambled on for an hour and we've barely even touched on the fact that the customers are being treated poorly, and the takeouts are I mean, they're just not competitive in a lot of ways. And, I mean, the product we're putting out there on a day-to-day basis just isn't very good. I mean, when you really get down to it, the day-to-day racing in this country stinks. I mean, even the little tracks, you turn on TVG on a Monday or Tuesday, even the little tracks have five-horse fields. And that didn't used to be. Just go to Equibase, look up 20 years from now, pick any date, look at the cards, then look what we have now. And it sucks. And it's just not that interesting. It's not that compelling. And you say to yourself, you know, like, if that part of the business doesn't improve, all this other stuff doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter. You know, if no one's willing to come in here and bet the races, you know, what else do we have? A lot of show horses.
Well, you made that prediction years ago, 15 years ago. You said we're going to end up going to the paddock, putting saddles on them, and somebody's going to hand up a first place, second place, and third place ribbon.
It'll be a lot safer.
We didn't even get to. I was going to ask you about revisiting synthetics too, which is certainly going to come to the part of the conversation.
Why not?
Well, and you would think that here, you know, 10, 12, 15 years later, that the technology on them might be better than, you know, the first incantation of it, maybe.
If I was a track like Santa Anita, I would do anything at this point.
We will visit this again, and it's great to have Chuck here in person, and you can always count on Chuck to tell you what's on his mind.
Now everybody hates me.
No. No.
I don't really care.
It's just so ridiculous.
I care less than Serling cares.
Want to thank Andy Serling and Brendan Walsh and Dr. Stephen Alday and Chuck for sitting in, and for Casey for fighting the good fight, and we're going to get him healthy. Everybody should pitch into that and encourage him along. get them home. I'm going to head to California this afternoon. We'll come to you from Santa Anita tomorrow. And we'll hope that some of these things can be addressed. One issue at a time, Chuck, right?
Yeah, man.
Thanks, everybody. Replay tomorrow, 6 to 9. Visit the website, podcast, stream, etc., archive. And we'll talk to you from Arcadia tomorrow morning.
It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
There are places where being who you are is a punishable offense. These places have many names, but the ones who flee have one. Refugee. And it is in the name of the refugee that Hyas has dedicated itself for the last 130 years. Created in the name of the Jewish people, 4.5 million rescued and resettled so far. When they said, "Give us your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free," we were the ones at the docks helping them breathe free. Only now it's a farmer from Darfur, a shop owner from Syria, a family from Ukraine, a child from Colombia, a Christian from Iran, a gay man from Uganda. The 65 million souls who still wander the earth in search of sanctuary. Why? Maybe it's because being Jewish means you don't have to be reminded never to forget. Hyas, for the refugee.
Visit HIAS.org to understand the mission and support the work of Hyas.
Why is accreditation important in aftercare? The Thoroughbred Aftercare Alliance's standard of accreditation and grant process provide donors with confidence that their contributions are allocated in the most effective manner. TAA accreditation is only awarded after a complete review of an organization. Aftercare cannot be an afterthought for the industry. To learn more or support the TAA's mission, visit thoroughbredaftercare.org.
Do you want unlimited access to handicapping without exorbitant prices? Then BridgeNet.com has you covered with a variety of plans for past performances, pedigree, and raw data. The BridgeNet.com Performance Plan offers unlimited PDF past performances for just $75 per month and is available at BridgeNet.com/PP. American Produce Records Online puts the pedigrees of nearly 1 million dams and more than 2 million foals at your fingertips, plus sire stats, for only $275 per year and is available at BrisNet.com/APR. The BrisNet.com data plan offers unlimited access to race day data files, perfect for handicappers with their own database or to plug into other people's programs. The data plan is just $125 per month. Visit BrisNet.com for all this information and more, and discover why BrisNet.com is the handicapper's edge.